Hi everyone, it's 8:30 or 8:31. The date is May 16th, and this is class number 15. Rabbi Kelman is not able to be here right now, but he'll be here soon, I'm told. So let us pick up. Today, as I said, today it's the 15th class. What I want to do is I want to bring it to a close the first era. I guess we can call it that. The first generation of reformers, which, as we saw, was still very halachic, even though you may call them liberal halachic. They were indeed liberal, even beyond liberal sometimes. But I want to bring that to a close, and then we'll move on. So before I do that, though, let me just turn this off here. Let me respond to some questions, finish up with things I want to do. And then I just want to do a few things today, and then we'll begin with, I guess, the second generation, introduce you to new figures. But just some things that came across my computer, my desk, not really relevant to this semester as much as, or I should say not this unit, as much as the Lieberman. I made a prediction. Conservative rabbis will soon be doing intermarriages. And lo and behold, that was in the news. There are already conservative rabbis doing it. You don't need to be a prophet or a wise man. You knew that it was coming. And although it's only a few outliers, it'll be pick up steam. And you can be sure that the Committee on Law and Standards will find a way to permit it. And if you know about halacha, you know exactly how they'll permit it. We're even going to see today maybe how Samuel Holdheim permits intermarriage, and that's going to be the exact way that the Committee of Law, in fact, the Committee of Law and Standards will probably throw in a chumrah. They'll say that we'll do an intermarriage with a non-Jewish woman, but you have to agree to raise the child Jewish. It means you have to agree to convert the child, even though the child's not Jewish. So, look, even the Reform had a chumrah. We all remember when they when they accepted patrilineal descent, and it was considered very controversial, but then they said that really it's not patrilineal descent. What they're saying is that even for matrilineal, you have to raise the child as Jewish. So the Reform movement's ruling was very machmir in that they said that if the mother's Jewish, but the child's not being raised Jewish, then we don't consider that child Jewish either. That's what they said. As far as I know, no one ever paid any attention to that. I don't think the Reform movement ever paid attention, but that was what they were saying. Their claim was that it's not patrilineal, it's that you need to have commitment. Point number one. Point number two, I was reviewing, we spoke just a few classes ago about what you can say in the vernacular, what not. I gave some examples. We spoke about the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We said about if you void your oaths, and we gave some other examples. Lo and behold, I'm reviewing the halachas of Sfiras Omer. This is Yalkut Yosef, Ravad Yosef, in Hilchos Sfiras Omer. Someone says, I'm freezing when I complete a sentence. Is that just everyone has that or just Ovadia has it? Please type in if anyone else has this problem as well. Not that I can do anything about it, I'd like to know at least. If you look in, no, okay, so people have told me no privately. So it could be Ovadia that it's on your end. If you're wireless, that could be an issue. Here's what Rav Yitzchak Yosef says, and he's reflecting Rav Ovad Yosef in Siman Tuf Pei Tes, Hilchos Sfiras Omer. Mitzvah Sfiras Omer b'chol lashon shu mevin. You can recite Sfiras Omer in any language. And it says, Afil Shona Kodesh, but even in Hebrew, if you do it in Hebrew, l'chadchila, if you want to do it in Hebrew, you have to understand it. And if you don't understand lashon kodesh, and you did it in Lashon HaKodesh, lo yatsa. The yachzor v'yispor b'lshon shemevin b'lo bracha. He says you need to repeat it. I don't know. The reason he says do it without a bracha is because it's a suffix, because there are some who hold that you are yotzei. But this is the standard halacha, as far as I can tell, that if you count Sfiras Omer and you don't understand it, you don't fulfill the mitzvah. Now, what does that mean not to understand it? Okay, it doesn't mean that you need to know every word, that you need to know what you need to. If I give you the text in Hebrew and I say that tonight is the 20th night of Yomer, in other words, you know that what you're saying means the 20th night, even if you don't know what the words, you don't know what Baruch means. You don't know what's how, you don't know what the numbers are, but you know that this is the 20th night, then you fulfill the mitzvah. But the question is, what about if you don't know what day it is? You're not sure. Is it 20, the 21st? And you read the words over. Do you fulfill it? I can't see how anyone would hold you fulfill it, but the Magen Avraham seems to say that you do. Although I'm not sure if he says you do or if he's... he might be saying what I just said, that you know it's the 20th day, but you don't know the words. That's enough. I can't imagine that if you literally don't know what day it is and you just recite the Hebrew words, that anyone holds it, you fulfill it. But I don't know. The Aruch HaShulchan, defense. The Aruch HaShulchan says that Boshona Kodesh ain't Sarach Sheyavim. You don't need to understand it. But I think the Aruch HaShulchan might mean that you know the day, it's just you don't know the meaning of the words. That's what I think. It needs a further investigation. And if you want to look in the Alkut Yosef, he discusses then what about Amalek? And it's the same thing, that as long as you know the basic idea of what's being said, you don't literally need to know the words, and there's other discussions. Okay. The Jewish Link this week. It has an article by Rabbi Chaim Jachter. He's spoken for Torah in Motion before about the late Rav Nota Greenblatt. And this relates just what we spoke about last class. We are talking about how sometimes the rabbis don't want to tell you, don't want to let the people have all the information. And they like to, keep it to themselves because they think it could be dangerous to let the masses have it. And he speaks about how, and he's written a number of stories. He said this is the age of the democratization of Torah, where we make every effort to make Torah available and accessible to all. And he talks about how he wrote a long piece discussing Gittin practices in America. And Rav Nosson said he shouldn't publish it because then unqualified rabbis would read it and think that they're able to do Gittin. I want to thank Rabbi Mordechai. Why do I want to thank Rabbi Mordechai? Because we spoke about, and Paul mentioned, he knew descendants of Maritz Chayas. We spoke about Svi Peretz Chayas, who's the grandson of the Maritz Chayas. Notice that someone writes here, also Svi Peretz Chayot. And and I told you, it's not Chayot. It shouldn't be Chayot. And in fact, I believe not here. I think maybe somewhere else. Here, look. Anyone could edit Wikipedia. So someone added this. Chayot learned in the yeshiva and was ordained as a rabbi. It should be Chayas. Any of you can change it. But as I mentioned, in Hebrew, people call it Chayot, even though that's not his language, that's not his name. He was never called Chayot. He was called Chayas. So I wondered if, because they mentioned that in Israel, the Supreme Court Justice, she's named... Chayut, I think, is a descendant. Well, lo and behold, and if you go to the Hebrew Wikipedia, you see, thank you, Rabbi Mordechai, Tzvi Peretz Chayas never married. So he never had children. Very interesting. And I want to thank Moshe. Moshe called my attention. We spoke about Lefrak. Wikipedia says it's Lefrak, but anyone from the New York area knows it's Lefrak. But I don't know how, if any of you know the family, you could let us know. And I said how surprised I was to find that the patriarch of the family, Harry, was head of Mizrahi, so involved. Well, Moshe sent me a lot of things. During the class, actually, he started doing searches. And look at some of the stuff he sent me. So here's a picture of Harry Lefrak on the left, at the groundbreaking for the Young Israel of Forest Hills. And I can send these things to anyone who's interested. And here's a, thank you again, Moshe. Here's a picture. He's a big Baal Tzedakah from one of the Yiddish papers of Harry Lefrak with Rav Avram Kalmanovitz, the Rosh Hashiva of the Mir. And last one I want to show you. Here he is helping out with the Lubavitch Yeshiva. So that's next time you hear Lefrak Village, although Lefrak City, although it's his son who did it, but a very chashuv Jew. So thank you for that. And one more thing I want to show you. Oh, and before I do that, one of our listeners asked me to share this, and you can please email me and I can give you the link, or you can just search on it, that ALS, there's a new medication that the FDA is dragging its feet on, and it's very important for many people. So there's this thing you can sign, a petition. So please just search for ALS Action Alert, and you can find that, or you can email me. We'll do what we can. The last thing I want to mention, and this gets back to the issue of the very learned woman of Mercada. And as we saw, the volume that this appeared in, I told you I wasn't sure how to pronounce it. Here. Was it Chaim Shanim? Chaim Shanim? I wasn't sure. Well, thanks. A few of you pointed out to me that there's a pasuk, although the pasuk doesn't go together. If you look in Exodus 22, verse 3, it says, in Yomasei Timatzei Biado Hagneva Mishor Ad Chamor Ad Se Chaim, comma, Shnayim Yishalem, you pay double. So for whatever reason, they make the play Chaim Shnayim. That's the name of the sefer. And I discussed the this woman who was so learned. I said that I don't think anyone's heard this. No one knows about it. Well, thank you, David Eisen. And then one other person pointed out there's a woman scholar in Israel named Yael Levin. And she wrote an article in Beit Morasha, in Akdamot, which is the Beit Morasha periodical, in 2003. And lo and behold, she publishes from manuscript she discusses the what we learned from about this woman. And I was wrong. I said the 19th century. The book was published in the 9th century. If you look at who she's corresponding with, she's in the 18th century. But she publishes from manuscript an unpublished tshuva of Rav Yitzchak Nissim, responding to this rabbi who says to Rav Nissim, why do you, because Rav Nissim appeared in an event, he gave a newspaper interview, and he said that women should learn Torah. So this rabbi from Bnei Brak writes to him, how could you say this? We know that women are supposed to learn Torah. And Rav Nissim has a long tshuva, and he quotes various sources of women Torah scholars. And then he says, we even have a tshuva. And he mentions this woman Mercado. Now, this is of interest because now I can explain how I came to this, the tshuva. And I never saw Yael Levin's article, which came out in 2003. So how do I find lots of stuff, which I find the unusual stuff? Well, people often ask me that. Well, first of all, I read a lot of tshuvot. And I have many Sephardic tshuvot from the 19th century. And here is an example. They all were reprinted in the 90s. Many of them looked like this. You know, I've seen these volumes. This is a Yalkushos tshuvos. I have many, many of these. And if you come to my house, you'll see loads of tshuvot. And you read these tshuvot, first of all, you learn interesting things, but they refer you to many other volumes and significant responses, unusual responses. But I can tell you 100% that I never read the work Chaim Shnayim. I don't have the volume. I have lots of volumes of 19th century tshuvot published in Izmir and other places in the Sephardic world. So how did I find this tshuva? I was asked this by a couple, but now I know the answer. And I thank you, Yael Levin, because I do have these volumes, which I picked up. They were published in the 2010s. Rav Yitzchak Nissim, his volumes, his larger volumes are called Yein HaTov. But then they published a number of volumes called Lichal Ulifrat Short Tshuvot. And so this is the first volume, which appeared around 4 or 5 years ago. So after David sent me the article, I picked it up. And lo and behold, not only do I find the tshuva here, but let me show you something else. Here's the page. Oops. Can you see it? I even marked it. This marking is from 4 or 5 years ago. So I marked the paragraph where he mentions, he says, Ureik Saktin Shekatava Harabanit Merkada B'Shev Shuvah Chaim Shnayim. So this is where I found it in Rav Nissim's volume. Like I said, I had never seen Dr. Levine, and Dr. Levine published it for manuscript, but then they reprinted it. If you went to Yad HaRav Nissim, you Today, you don't need to because it's all online, all of our missing stuff. The Hebrew, the Jewish National Library put it online, but you could have seen all the tshuvot there. Very helpful. I published some stuff from Renisa's archive also, but I never saw that responsum as far as I know. Let me put this away. Let us pick up. If you recall last class, as I'm closing up, I mentioned the Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, how I really see him as a pre-modern authority. Even though he set the response to reform, we will see, for instance, Rav Shamshon Rav Arush, a very different response to reform and a different approach to Judaism. Do we want to live in a ghetto? Do we want to live separate? Or no, do we want to live among the nations? Hirsch is going to even speak about Jews having a mission. We think of reform being the ones, we're going to see all about the reform. They talk about the mission that the Jews have. We have a mission to civilize the world and to bring ethical monotheism. Well, according to Shamshon or Hirsch, we also have a mission. But we'll get to that. And I gave you some examples of the Chassam Sofer. And I think another example, which shows you that the Chassam Sofer in many ways was living in his own world, not integrated, not acculturated, because we're going to see that he cites something which you can't imagine, let's say, a Shamshon Rav Hirsch or anyone with a secular education citing this, because they would know the context. So this is his commentary on the Torah. It's Chassam Sofer on Torah. If you can Parsha Shoftim, he deals with Shoftim and Shotrim. You should set up judges in your judges. You know, Shofate, we translate it as judges. We have the book of Judges. And we think of a judge like a Supreme Court justice or someone with the black robes. That's not what a shofate is, really. It's like a leader. It's like someone in charge. It's not someone who you bring court cases to, although you could, I guess, if it's a leader. But that's not, when you think of the judges, Deborah and Shimshon and all of them, they're not judges like we think of judges, like your local superior court judge. That's not what it is. But that's the word that is used. Okay, and then so the Chassam Sofer is going to explain what this is. He says, I want to explain it. Kasvu Chazal, based upon what, or Shamru, what Chazal said, Ein Navi Leiro. Chazal said there is no prophet in one's own city. And therefore, he says that what they would do is they would appoint a shofate from a different city to be in, not in his city, but in a different city. Why? Because people don't respect the local person as a judge. There's no judge in his own city. Well, I have to say that this does not appear in Chazal. And some of you might already know this appears nowhere else but the book of Matthew. They took offense at him, and Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town and in his own home. So Jesus says that a prophet gets honor everywhere but in his own home. The Chassam Sofer is not the first one to cite this passage. Many people cite it, and it became accepted that this is a Maamar Chazal, but it's not a Maamar Chazal. There's a whole group of these, what I call phantom Maamar Chazal. Some of them come from Christian sources, some from Islamic sources. Some we don't know where they come from, and that's one of the most famous ones. But the Chassam Sofer, what does he know about the New Testament? And this, he'd have no really way to access this. I think that shows the isolation. And we have many examples of this, but I want to give you one which shows you isolation of a different sort. That, and also with a great, great figure, another Moshe, but a later Moshe, and that's Rav Moshe Feinstein. In 1975, this document was published with Rav Moshe Feinstein as the president of Agudas Rabbanim. I'll just translate it for you. I'll read it. We are in shock that some rabbis, Rabbis there refers to Orthodox rabbis. Usually when you write rabbis that way, you mean non-Orthodox rabbis. But here they mean Orthodox rabbis, but the liberal Orthodox rabbis, modern Orthodox rabbis. In fact, I think I know one of the modern Orthodox rabbis he refers to, but I don't want to say the name because I'm not 100% certain, but I believe I know who it is. Because when I once gave a talk and I cited this, someone told me that it's Rabbi X. So some of these rabbis have permitted themselves to give a heter to carry money on Shabbos with the excuse that, remember, this is the bad days. These are the days of the 70s, which unfortunately New York City seems to be descending to, if hopefully the mayor, current mayor, can get us out of this. But we all remember how terrible it was, and the crime, and the anyone who lived, as I did, through that era, although I lived in New Jersey, but we used to have to come into New York all the time, you know what I'm talking about. But they give a heter that if you're going out on Shabbos, you can carry money, because then if you're mugged, you can give the person something and he won't kill you. And he says, as we've seen, we've had, crimes in our city in New York. And then they says that this reason, this justification of pikuach nefesh, is mezuyaf. It's completely false. And so we, that is Agudas Rabbanim, we warn all those with a strong warning not to rely on this heter, this false heter. And anyone who carries money on Shabbos, you're machal Shabbos. Because at the end of the day, the odds of you being mugged are still very small. And if they do mug you, the odds that if you don't have money, that if you open up your pockets, most of them will just go away. The odds are going to kill you or attack you if you don't. They obviously think that this is not enough of a reason to violate Shabbos. Achenu Hayudim, Jewish brethren, don't let yourself be led astray by these permissive rabbis. Don't violate Shabbos, which is the soul of all of Israel. Ukfar amru chachmenu zichron levracha. And Chazal, I've already said, Yoter shayudi shomeres haShabbos, haShabbos shomeres haYehudi. More than the Jew observes the Shabbos watches over the Jew. And therefore, be strong in Shmirah Shabbos, and Shabbos will save us from all difficulties and problems. And Israel will be redeemed through the zchus of the Shabbos, and we should have a Geula Shleima. Well, I have to say here that it's a very nice saying. More than the Jews have observed the Shabbos has more than Jews have watched observed the Shabbos has watched over the Jews. It's a very nice saying, but it wasn't said by Chazal. And some of you I see are smiling. You know who was said by? It was actually said by this individual, Achad Ha'am. And it's a great saying. He said it in a, he came from good religious background, Sever Hasidic background, because it actually is a good religious message, but it's not a Maimar Chazal. This, in one of his essays, Shabbat Tzioniyot, he speaks all about the importance of Shabbos. And the importance of Shabbos. The people like him were not being medaktik, I'd say not to carry or even not to smoke, but the idea that you'd have public events, it has to be, that was considered unacceptable. You need to make the day a special day. So you'd have learning sessions, lectures, things like that. And he says, anyone who even has any connection with the Jewish people, he won't, he can't imagine, without the Shabbos. And then he says, then here's the words, Efshar lo emor b'li shum hafraza, we can say without exaggeration, ki yoter mish Yisrael shomeru et ha-Shabbat, shomerah ha-Shabbat otam. More than the Jewish people have observed the Shabbos has observed them. And yet here we see, it's a Maimar Chazal, more than the Jews observe the Shabbos observed the Jew. But I do have to say, it's good Jewish, it's a good Jewish message. If you look in the Taz, in Shulchan Aruch Arachayim, Reish Samach Zayin, Hilchos Shabbos, Halacha Aleph, he says, quoting the Torah, that the reason you don't say, we don't ask on Shabbos for God to watch over us, because he quotes a Midrash. Let's see here. I have my little number here to Zion. It'll tell me where this... Well, it's actually, we don't know where this Midrash is, but it is found in the Zohar. I see on my notes here. It says, Shabbos ain't Sarach Shmira. Shabbos Shomer. That is, we don't need to worry about that we need Shmira from God on the Shabbos, because the Shabbos is... And then it says, "V'nogin l'mar pasuk." We say, "V'sham b'nei Yisrael so Shabbos." We say that b'nei Yisrael observe the Shabbos. L'mar she'im yishmer Shabbos ain't shara shmirah. To say that if the Jews observe the Shabbos, they don't need shmirah. Why don't they need shmirah from God? Because the Shabbos is watching over them. So it is the idea. Although the exact lashon is achad am lashon. He, as I said, from good Jewish background, he's good religious background. It's a completely very from religiously sourced idea that you observe the Shabbos, and the Shabbos, as it were, will watch over you. Just like you give tzedakah, it'll come back to you as well. But it's not a Maamar Chazal in those exact words. As for the other thing, I read this last week. I was going to talk about it last week. We didn't get to it. And just last week, Rav Yitzhak Yosef, because of all the terrorism going on in Israel now, he gave a psak that if you have a license for a gun, you should bring it to shul on Shabbos. Now, it's true there have been some terrorist attacks, but it's a country of many, many millions of people and many shuls, and it's not like terrorist attacks are happening every day. It's not like in your local shul, there's a real suffix of someone coming in. Anything could happen. Anything could happen here. That guy in Buffalo, he hated Jews as much as he hated blacks. He could have just as easily walked into the shul. But... And I know there are people, and my brother's in a shul down in Florida, and people come to shul packing every Shabbos. And the rabbis never said it's a problem. So if you can come to shul with a gun on Shabbos, because of the far-fetched chance that it might happen, but after all, it's pikuach nefesh, so you got to be careful. You know, in the 70s in New York, it doesn't seem that far removed, I guess. But the Gurus Rabbanim thought differently. So let's close this out. One more thing before we go on. I want to repeat something which I told you a few semesters ago, but a number of you weren't here, so you didn't hear it. I think you'll enjoy this. If your only knowledge of Torah, of Judaism, comes from inside the yeshiva walls, you never would have heard of a Chadam. You wouldn't know it's his saying. And if the saying somehow gets passed around, becomes popular, then it makes sense. And it's a good saying. You'll say it, just like Ein Navi Be'iro. There's no prophet in his own city. You can see how that happens. It could easily, these sorts of sayings, and there's many, could easily infiltrate into a religious environment. And it reminds me how when I was young, we used to go to Borough Park for Shabbatons, and we always used to joke for ourselves that we could start singing any tune, modern tune, and we would go to, they'd set us up, this thing called JEP, it was called, Jewish Educational Program. We go to Borough Park, we put up at these real Hasidic houses where no TVs. That was such a shock, you know, in a house without a TV. And would have no knowledge of any of these things. And because I remember sometimes we'd ask them questions about things and they wouldn't know. We could, so the joke was, I never did it, but the old joke was that we could sing Nigunim with popular tunes. And there were ones. One of the Simon and Garfunkel songs became a popular Nigun. I heard it when I was in Scranton. The Beach Boys has something that's popular in Nigun. But I heard Edut Nemana from a friend of mine who was at Rutgers in the 1980s. Only the people 50 years and older will know what I'm talking about. That they would see, that they would do a Nigun at the Chabad house there to the Bumblebee tune. Die, 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 die. Well, here it is. I found everything's on YouTube. Oops, hold on. I got to give you the tune here. So let me, if people over 50 and older, they'll know what I'm talking about. Others live and learn. But we all know this, as those of us who are on TV. So it's a good nigga. Die, 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 die. Very nice. The Bumblebee tune. It was put on by the Bumblebee. I don't know how he got it. There's another one from the Bumblebee company. I don't know how these people find these things that they put on YouTube. The last thing I want to show you is takes us back to show you how everything is context. We have seen now how it's forbidden to abridge the Siddur. It's forbidden to abridge prayers, make any changes, because that's reform. What about if you're in an era without reform. We already saw about music. Music is now acceptable in Israel. They're playing music at the non-Dati Lomi religious Zionist places. So I'm going to show you something that comes from Lakewood. And yet, if it was 200 years ago, this too would be a reform. I mean, well, I'll show you in a minute. And this is then going to return us to a figure who we spoke a good deal about in the when we dealt with the book. Rabbi Yitzhak Abadi of Lakewood. Unusual posek, liberal posek. He was the official posek in the Lakewood Yeshiva, but he had interesting ideas, still does have interesting ideas. And I remember when I was in Yeshiva High School, we heard about this posek in, and there was, we had teachers from Lakewood who were teaching JC that all gum in America is kosher. I told you about some of his interesting ideas that you don't eat hashkachas, except if there's no milk and cheese, no cheese and meat. And he has chumras also. For instance, one of his big chumras is that at weddings, you need a male photographer and a woman photographer, because you can't have male photographers taking videos or pictures of the women dancing. Now, I can tell you, I worked for 2-3 years at Haredi weddings. I worked first at Simcha by the Sea, the catering hall for Shabbos, but then I used to work, my new house would have affairs, and I'd work during the week at weddings. So when I say weddings, I'm talking about the whole Litvisha world and the Hasidisha world. That's where I first saw the mitzvah tants, if you remember, I showed you way back when. And I have never seen, you can correct me if I'm wrong, people who go to more Haredi weddings, I don't go to that many anymore, but I had never seen then women photographers hired to take videos of the women's side of the dancing. But that's what Rabbi Abadi says. And Rabbi Abadi was the first one to speak about bugs. Before it was fashionable, no one was talking about bugs. And he already in the 70s was saying that you can't eat things like cauliflower. Now it's pretty accepted. A lot of kulas, leniencies. And one of his ideas is that all gum is kosher. You want to get your Wrigley's, if you don't believe me, here's a website put out by his son and followers. This is from, I just pulled this up before. Wrigley's Extra Spearmint Gum. You show them the ingredients, the answer is kosher. And what's the problem? Why should gum be a problem? Rabbi Abadi doesn't think so, because the flavors are kosher. He's determined that. And the only thing is what you're chewing on. And he says that that's not an issue. If you want to see the other position, the standard position, you can see an article online by the late Rabbi Zusha Blech, Gum Zu Letova, he calls it. And he goes through explaining the whole thing about gum, the problems, and he has all these issues about the gum, what you chew on, the base, and the glycerin and all that, and he has all the reasons why it's a problem. None of these things Rabbi Abadi thinks are a problem at all. He doesn't think they're food. He doesn't think that the synthetic rubber is an issue. It's a different approach to how to understand Hilchos Kashrus. By the way, when I was at the New York Public Library last week, going through this part of my halachic history of America, I found advertisements. I had heard about this, but I didn't know. This is from 1933. One of the very first OU hashkachas was on that same spearmint milk, spearmint gum, which other than Rabbi Abadi, you can only eat it, I guess, when you're in Israel, where it's kosher at the local kosher store. OU gave hashkacha. I contacted Wrigley's about 15 years ago, asked them why they don't have hashkacha anymore. And they said, the reason they said was because of the gum base is processed in different places and they can't guarantee where it comes from. So from a Rabbi's perspective, the base is meaningless. You're not eating the base. One of his sons said that, either I asked or someone else, I don't remember. One of his sons said, it's like chewing on your baseball mitt. That your baseball mitt can be made out of pig skin, but it's certainly made out of non-kosher non-shechted animal. And there's no problem chewing on the baseball mitt if your kid's stuck out in, I gave this example once, that if your kid's stuck in left field, you don't have to scream at him, stop chewing on the, or I should say right field, stop chewing on your baseball mitt. Because it's not eating. So here we see this is from 1933. And it wasn't just 1933. I found another one. This is from the Orthodox Union, the OU stuff magazine. Full of great stuff to the time. Here, this is from 1949. And you see Wrigley's is still under Hashgacha. And they didn't have many Hashgachas then. It was very small, the OU. But what do I want to show you? I want to show you something else. Rabbi Abadi came out with a bencher. Those of you who were with us in the early semesters, right after COVID, when we dealt with my most recent book, you'll remember this, but seen it once, it's worth seeing again. Rabbi Abadi came out with a bencher. It's an abridged bencher. Here it is. You can see it. You can get it. This is my copy. I have a bunch of them. They make them nice laminated. You have to go to Lakewood to get it. Oh, a friend of mine bought it for me and sent it. I saw them when I was in Flatbush once, so I said they're nice to have. And he says at the bottom that this version of Birkas HaMazon is based on the Rambam and the other Rishonim, and if it's difficult for you to say the entire version, you can be yotzei with this evil chachila, and he says it's better to have a little with kavana than to have a lot without kavana. So here you have a bencher. You know, you're out, you go out to a restaurant, you eat, or you're at home, and benching's long. And here you fulfill it, you say it, and according to Rabbi Abadi, at least, you fulfill the entire. When I was one scholar in residence at one of the Syrian shuls, and at the family we're at, this is what they use Shabbos. I mean, sometimes during the week I'll use this, but on Shabbos it's probably better to do the real one. You're not in such a hurry. But so what's the basis of this? This is reform, isn't it? It's you're cutting down the tefillah here. It's like the reformers. You're chopping it up. How is this permissible? Why isn't this reform? Well, it's all context. It's not reform because today the Orthodox are really not threatened by the reform. And look at his justification. I'll show you his justification. He has a whole response. It's in his Sefer Or Yitzchak, volume 1, number 59. He says that there are many nuslaos on benching. He says that this short version, which I came out with, is not something that I knew. In the Rishonim, they mentioned shorter versions. And he says, and why, and the Achronim, and he says, why do we have this? He says that, who ki tamid hayu anashim, the nashim, they're always men and women that didn't say Birkas HaMazon because it's too long. And Birkas HaMazon we know is Daraisa. Racha Rishona is Darabanan, Achrona is Daraisa. He says, therefore, look, this is language. And don't tell me he's a reformer. You saw his long beard. He was the posek of the Lakewood Yeshiva. He says, "Kedai lekatzer. It's better to shorten it. Kedai so that the people sheitzu ikar chovasam beimin etar beimin drabanan." He says it's better so that everyone fulfill their obligation. He says, and in our day, harbei anashim, knowingly and not knowingly, they eat all these lachmaniot, the rolls, I guess mizonos rolls, u pizza, and also pizza and falafel, and they say you make a mizonos on it. And he says that they're mistaken and they're causing people this error. And why do they care about mizonos rolls? Why do they have the whole concept of mizonos rolls? Which Rabbi Abadi thinks is a crock. The whole thing is because why? Because people think benching is too long and they don't want to do it. So therefore they say, oh, it's almost only mizonos rolls. So better, he's saying, is to actually wash and make a mizona and make a Birkas HaMazon than do this phony thing of not considering it really hamotzi. And he says, in our day and age, many men, and particular women, especially that live in America, they don't know Hebrew. They don't know Hebrew so well. And they didn't say they didn't bench at all. But now that I've put out this bencher, Baruch Hashem, I have many zechuyot because many men and women are saying Birkas HaMazon. And then he goes further. He says, hold on, next page. He says, and what about the fact that now there are people who used to do the long bracha, and now they're doing the short one? He says it's not a problem. What's because since they're Yotze with the short version anyway, lo kedai lahastir nusach hazem yel shalom yirachim kol bigal kitzurim shalom arichim. He says it's not doesn't pay. It's not correct to keep this hidden. The idea that you can be Yotze with a shorter version, because we're afraid that the people who say the longer version, really the better best approach, that now they're going to start saying the shorter one. No, because these people are Yotze anyway. So they're, and we want the people who now are eating pizza and saying it's mazonos or not benching at all, we want them to bench. And therefore, if the people who are saying the long version now are going to say the short version, it's really not such a problem because you're Yotze with that anyway. And then he says, and I'm going to say more, even those who used to say the long version now say the short version, he says that this is a good thing, and this is why I use it. Sometimes the harbei arichus abrachim here says man because benching is long and you have to go somewhere quickly. Einam noslim leiv kol amashim otzim b'fiyim. They don't always pay attention to what they're saying. Va'ata kevan shemavarachim nusam akutzar, because now that they're saying with the short version, you can be machaven. You know, you can actually say every word and focus on it. When it's the long one, we know that unless you're singing it, you know, we skim through it. And he says many have told me this. And then he goes on, he gives more examples of it, and then he includes it, the version here. And as he says that, Tov Ma'at B'Kavana, Meharbot B'Chol B'Kavana, it's better to say a shorter version with Kavana than it's better to say the longer with Kavana. But if it's a choice between the longer without and the shorter with, he says it's better to say, now I don't know, well, others might disagree and not hold of this version of Birkat HaMazon. In my shul, we had for a number of years one of his talmidim. So I got all the shitas of Rabbi Abadi. So I'm not saying anyone to adopt this, but this, you could see how today someone would say this is, years ago, you could say this is a reform. Today, you won't say it's a reform. You'll simply say that this is not the right approach. Maybe halachically, you cut out things you shouldn't have. But the notion that we can make changes in the siddur and it'll be regarded as reform, that's from the past. We move beyond that, I believe. And with that, but of course, if this bencher had been published 200 years ago by the reformers, Ela Devar Brit would go after it, that they're cutting out the benching and all that. Incidentally, as we end here, let me just say about gum. Gum's an interesting thing here because there's actually a machokes. Do you make a bracha rishona on gum? You definitely don't make a bracha chrona, but a bracha rishona, there are a number of people who hold, I think it's the minority view. If you look in Rav Moshe Levy's book, Birkas Hashem, Rabbi Mazuz says this as well, Birkas Hashem, chapter 1. He says explicitly, and so does Rabbi Mazuz, you do not make a bracha rishona on gum because Eino boleat gufa mastigat smo rakata roksha b'fiv shenichnas bo tama matikut. You're not swallowing anything of substance. You're just getting a taste in your mouth. And it's not like you take a taste of, let's say, a taste of a cookie, because then there's mamushos, as we would say. This is a minority view, I believe. I know it's a minority view. You do taste the sugar. Rabbi Blech, in his article, takes up this issue and says, absolutely, you make the bracha. But these are important rabbis who say also have this view that you don't say it. Just so you're aware of it, that the whole issue of gum is a question. I'm assuming you don't make a bracha chrona. I've never heard of anyone say you do make a bracha chrona, but maybe there are people. If anyone thinks I'm wrong on this, please let me know. I just right now assumed that you don't make it. I've never done it, and I never because what's you're making it, eating kazayas? What are you eating? You're not really eating anything. But if this is I have a problem with that view also, because if you're not eating, then what? Then you could eat that on Yom Kippur? No, of course you can't, because you're getting a taste out of it. I would think that there'd be a parallel between on a fast day. If you can't eat it on a fast day, then it has some significance that you make a bracha on. I haven't gone through the whole sugya. I just read through some of Rabbi Levy's notes, but that's of interest. By the way, Rabbi Blech, who passed away a couple of years ago, was a big loss. I had a run-in with him, a little bit of a run-in, but it's okay. I used to always get at home the soft matzah, because that's the authentic matzah, I think. Korech, how can you do korech with our hard matzah? It has to be wrapped. So I get it. I drive in to Flatbush, and I would actually bring it to the hotels I used to go to. The first few years I went to hotels under private hashkachas, I show it to them, no problem. And then I was going to places under then I was told by the VOD of Broward County, no problem, I could use it. But then I was at a hotel that was under Rabbi Blech's hashkacha, and he wouldn't let me. So I said to him, "What's you don't trust hashkacha? It comes from the Syrian Haredim." He goes, "It has nothing to do with that." Basically, he said, I don't know if these exact words, but if it was Moshe Rabbeinu who gave hashkacha, I still wouldn't allow it because we have a policy which we can't bring outside things in. So I guess I get that because, you know, if you start making exceptions for Mark Shapiro, because remember, they also have to heat the matzah up. You have to eat the matzah. You can't eat it. It's like pizza. So you have to heat it up. So now it's in the ovens, which again, they all allowed it. All these mashkichim who were hardly mekilim and the VOD of Broward County. But Rabbi Blech said that if we start making exception for you, then people are going to come with various medicines and this and that, and then you can't have a kosher Pesach program. So I accepted what he said. I wasn't upset, but it just shows you that how careful he was on kashrus. When it closed down, the doghouse in Teaneck, the sports bar, he was the one that gave the hashkacha when the VOD of Bergen County refused to give hashkacha. Rabbi Blech did. And he has a very nice book on halachas of kashrus. Not a posek, but he's an expert on kashrus. Okay, with this, we end this. We're going to start now. We're moving into, I guess, unit two of the rise of reform and the rabbinic response. When we go to Europe in the summer, a lot of these things that we speak about have relevance, especially when we go to Central Europe, but we're not going to Central Europe. So anyone who's listening live, anyone who's listening on YouTube or on tape, you can still sign up for the summer trips. We got space, and we'll have lots of fun and see great things. And if you're ready to travel, I'm ready.
Although only in Italy and Spain. Portugal is pretty much sold out.
Okay.
Maybe we can squeeze in two more people, but that's about it. So,
thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Okay, everyone. Part two, I guess you can call it. We've seen how most of those who associate themselves with the temples in Berlin and Hamburg did so because they found it meaningful for personal reasons, for social reasons. They found it religiously meaningful. Prayers that reflected their mentality, that were comprehensible. There was a sermon in the vernacular, prayers in the vernacular. They found it much closer to the Christian milieu with the organ and everything we spoke about. But few of them gave much attention to philosophical questions, the philosophical issue of Judaism's viability in the modern age. They were more concerned with a service that appealed to them. However, it's in the second and the third generation of reform, as we shall see, that people began to focus on the fact that unless Judaism was made intellectually respectable, or put it in quotes, intellectually respectable, and not just socially and aesthetically respectable, that nothing would last. Remember, the first generation was about social concerns, aesthetic concerns. We saw all the aesthetic concerns. You want to have a choir. You want to have someone in a robe looking a certain way. You want to have the sermon. You want to have dignified services, everything. And that's aesthetic and the social aspect as well. But what about the intellectual aspect? Is traditional Judaism believable in the modern world? That's going to be an important point for the second and third generation. Now, there are many Reform thinkers who deal with this. Names Steinheim, Forstecher, Samuel Hirsch, to be distinguished from Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. But I don't want to focus on it. Their influence is not so much in the context of the movements of Judaism, but you can pick up books of studies of Jewish philosophy, and you can see discussions of their philosophy. I want to pick up, because we're dealing with not the history of Jewish philosophy, but the history of Jewish religious movements. So I want to look at two figures who are significant figures in the communal sense. The first one is Samuel Holtheim, who we'll look at briefly, and the next one is Abraham Geiger, who had a great influence and really locked horns, as we shall see, with the rabbis. And as we shall also see, he comes from a rabbinic family of the highest caliber. So this is going to move us now mid-19th century Germany, where we can say that over 50% of the Jewish population in the mid-19th century Germany, we have figures that give us good estimates, but over 50% in the mid-19th century are not observant. And in the large cities, it's much more than that. But in the small towns, traditionalism still continued. This is one of the dangerous things, is that the people in a small town, they don't know much. They listen to the rabbi. So if you have a rabbi, you have a small town, maybe 20 families, a little shul. If the rabbi decides to join Reform, and all the rabbis who joined Reform had traditional backgrounds, but if they decide to join Reform, then they come and they tell the local community that, you know, the rabbis, I came just came from a conference, and the rabbis decided now we can do this and now we can do that. What are the local villagers? They're Amaratzim. They'll say, well, the rabbi said it, now we can do it. And that was a big danger, as we shall see. So here is Samuel, or Shmuel, as he would have been known whole time. I have a picture of him here. As it says, he was one of the more extreme leaders of the early Reform movement of Judaism, a pioneer in modern Jewish homiletics. He was often at odds with the Orthodox community. Dates are 1806 to 1860. He was from Poland. Actually, Kempen, it says here. South Central Poland. I don't know why they're calling it South Prussia, although Prussia would have included that. It was a province of it, but it's confusing. But it's Poland. The name Harlap. Sorry, no, not the name. What's the name Harlap? I want to show you something. Tshuva by Rabbi Harlap. I'll show you that in a second. But before I get to that, in his late 20s, after he received a rabbinic education, yeshiva education, very good education. Then in his late 20s, he attends universities in Berlin and Prague, but he doesn't stop his Torah learning even then. In Prague, while he's going to the university, he's learning under Rav Shmuel Landau. Rav Shmuel Landau was the son of the Noda Yehuda, the author of important works in his own right. And then he's appointed Rav of a city, Frankfurt am Oder. Who remembers who was the rabbi in Frankfurt am Oder before? Shaul Berlin. Unfortunately, Frankfurt am Oder is getting some of these characters. But when he's appointed as a rabbi, he's appointed as a traditionalist rabbi. We even have a tshuva, a responsum, in this sefer. Sorry, in this sefer, Ateres Tzvi. The rabbi's name is Harlap to Holtheim. And here it is. It's Chaf Zayin. No, sorry, not Chaf Zayin. Chaf Dalet. Look at the way he describes him. Gives him all these highfalutin descriptions. Harav, Moragol, Havrech, Rabba de Malka, who Hachacham Hashalim Bemada Usuna. He's also not just a great rabbi, but also one who has secular knowledge. Hamaforsa Matila, Morena Rav Shmuel. And then he's been appointed Av Basten of Kila Kadosha, Frankfurt to Oder. So you see that in his early years, Shmuel Holtheim was like a lot of these form rabbis. Not only is traditional, he's given respect by the Poskei Hador. This name Harlap. If you have any connection to YU, you know there's a family Harlap, Mizvun Harlap, that we had classes in Torah Moshe and Rav Yaakov Moshe Harlap. The Talmud Chaver of Rav Kook, it's not actually a name Harlap. If you notice it, there's two squiggly marks between the Laman and the Pei. It's an abbreviation, it's Rashi Tevos, and it goes back hundreds of years to a man named Chia, who was said to have come from Spain. And after the expulsion, he ends up in Poland, and he becomes the leader of the community of exiles, and we're told that the name is an acronym, Chia Rosh Lagole Poland. Chia Rosh Lagole Poland. And How do we know this? Because there's an old Megillas Yochsin from the Harlap family. And they're all related, these Harlaps. And that's what it tells us. So this is a very old tradition. Obviously, when Holtheim is in Frankfurt am Oder, he's not a reformer. Later, however, he would become the chief rabbi of the Grand Duchy of Mecklenburg-Schwerin. That also should ring a bell. Mecklenburg-Schwerin, that was where we had the issue with, they turned to Mendelssohn and Yaakov Emden about, because the Duke there said that they can't bury immediately. They have to leave it out for a few days. While there, he becomes more radical. And by 1847, when he leaves this pulpit, he then would end up in Berlin. He is the leading champion of radical reform. As we saw in the Wikipedia first or second line, he was known as an extreme reformer, which is absolutely correct. He had little tolerance for compromises, we'll see next week. His opponents see him as an enemy of Judaism, yet he thought that he was purifying Judaism. And we will, next class, we will deal with Holtheim and Abraham Geiger, as well as the rabbinic response to them, to both of them. So let me take the questions and the comments here. Paul tells us, as the great Rabbi Sharantra said, what comes out of your mouth is more important than what goes in. Heard from a Haredi on my pulpit. Yes, well, Jesus was... that's referring to kashrus, like it's not as important what comes in your mouth as what goes out of your mouth. But he's not really rejecting kashrus. Just like the Haredi Rav could say it, so Jesus could say it, I guess, without rejecting kashrus, the halacha, that yes, it's obviously important what goes in your mouth, but even more important what goes out of your mouth. If you've never heard the New Testament, you don't know this expression, you could get up in a frum shul, as Paul testifies, and people will say, sounds good. And it could sound good. There's Jesus had some messages. I applied to Jesus what Albeck, I think it was Albeck, applied to Yitzhak Halevi. All that is good is not new, and all that is new is not good. He said it in German. So in other words, anything you find good in Jesus, it's not new. He took it from us. And anything you find good, it's not new. And anything you find new, it's not good. That's what we would say, I think. Naftali says, the late 60s, early 70s, Washington Heights, the trash. Knew the Jews did not carry money on Shabbos, but during the week, if you were accosted, they would say, it is not Friday nor Saturday, you must be carrying money. Okay, that, after a while, they'd learn. If they mugged you a few times, they'd learn it doesn't pay to go out mugging on Friday night. Ruth says, the Tetris tune was also passed off as Nigun by my son's 10th grade Gemara class in TA Baltimore. I don't know Tetris tune, so I'm not sure what the tune is. So you'll have to share it with us. Rivka says she was just at a wedding in Muncie, and for the first time I saw women photographers photographing the women. Okay, I guess it had to come, Rivka. It's Rabbi Body was speaking about it 50 years ago, a voice in the wilderness. But today people are looking for things, so that's like an easy chumrah you can do.
So Rabbi Mark, are you too old to have played that game on early computers? Tetris. It was like a little game on the computers.
No, I didn't. I may be too old for that.
Maybe you are, yeah. Okay. But they passed it off. They fooled their Rebbe because they would sing it, and he thought it was a great niggun.
I heard that they would do this in Israel with Simon and Garfunkel tunes, that they would sing them. And I don't know if it's apocryphal, because the guy who told me said we told him it was Simon and Garfunkel, and he thought, oh, it sounds good. So, but I can tell you that the bumblebee is real, or at least... my friend who was at the Chabad house told me that. In terms of the NRA insignia, is that the National Rifle Association or is that a different NRA? Was there a National Rifle Association in 33? I don't know, but...
yes, it was the NRA. It said, we do our part, you do your part. It was very disturbing.
Oh, you're right. I'm just looking. Founded in 1871. Founded in 1871. So the NRA is old. Well...
and a donkey.
I say every Jew of 40, 45. No, I forget the rhyme.
Every Jew of 42.
Every Jew of 42. Look, listen, I have this.
Look at the next comment. Yeah, you should look at the next post. I think it meant the national recovery.
Right.
The National Recovery?
I agree.
Okay. National Recovery was the Roosevelt administration. Very good. Thank you. I didn't think it was NRA, that NRA, but you never know. So there's a rabbi who lives near my house. I'm going to pull up the thing now to see. Yes, it says we do our part. Yes, so that's not, that wouldn't be the National Rifle Association. Why don't NRA member? Wait, so I'm going to pull it up for you guys to see again here, because we'll need to get to the bottom of this. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. If no one gets to the bottom of this now, we'll get to the bottom of my next class. It says NRA member.
See, look at that. And there's an eagle holding. Is that the symbol of the NRA or is that the symbol of the United States?
I don't know. I don't know what the NRA would have to do with Wrigley's.
That is a symbol of the National Recovery Administration from 1933.
Ah, thank you very much. Very good.
So, that's correct.
But I do have a rabbi who lives near me who's head of this organization, about an Orthodox rabbi of Jews and guns. So we have all types. Let's see. Thank you very much, by the way, Justin. Avadia says, why should my dishwasher turn to be kosher? I rarely chew or eat my dishes. Even the OU doesn't say that the dishwasher turn has to be kosher. That's definitely pogrom. No one says that lafi strict halacha that the dishwasher detergent has to be kosher.
They give hashgacha on.
I understand. Well, they give hashgacha to your Thai detergent, your Thai detergent, your clothing detergent also has hashgacha on it, and lots of things. If you read my post, you know that toilet bowl cleaner has hashgacha. If the company wants to pay for it, and there might be a chumrah about dishwasher detergent, but it's not a meikar hadin. But the reason for it, Ovadia, not because you chew on your dishes. The idea would be that maybe the pots would be bolmeya, it's called. They would absorb tarfus in the detergent. So it's, as far as I know, the post-scheme today say it's not an issue. But years ago, it was an issue. Because years ago, they used to, it wasn't like our detergents, which are clearly pogging. They used to use other lard and other things. So you definitely needed kosher dish stuff, 100%. But it's because of the taste being absorbed into the pot, not because we will chew on, and then the pot, it's really the pot, not the dishes, because the pot is a klirishon, and then when you cook in the pot, the tarfus would then be absorbed. So that was definitely something. Rabbi Yellen says, yes, the Rabbi Body maintains it's permitted to open refrigerator, and not just in Yom Tov, on Shabbos also.
Yeah, I corrected it later. He says on Shabbos.
Yeah, we dealt with that. That's one of his big kuas. We dealt with that some semesters ago. And Rabbi Kelman says the same passage where Flutner said it, Jason, about slichos. A few of them with kavana, but a lot without kavana. But
say a lot without.
That's what people do. You mean, yeah, tov ma'ad.
No, he said his quip. How much slichas? They skip a lot of slichas in yeshiva. Tov ma'ad.
They
very little.
Yes.
It's a cute line. I like that one, but okay.
By the way, Rabbi Yellen, Rabbi Simon told me, I was at YU, incidentally, last week. I spoke at YU a week ago, so. All you have to do is go into to get in there. It's like getting into the White House. You can't get in there unless you're invited. Everything, the thing is shut down. No outside visitors. So I was able to get in because I'm speaking there. So Rabbi Baruch Simon, Big Tom, one of our bodies. So he's sitting. You always find him with probably 150 books on his desk, right? When you walk in the library. I hadn't seen the library. They redid it. It's beautiful. In the last couple of years, they redid it. He had told me a number of years ago that he told Rabbi Body not to publish this tshuva about the refrigerator because it's... We went through. We discussed it, the segregation of Michele, all that. Yes, that's what Hadassah was saying, that Kepno was part of Prussia from the second partition of Poland. Poland was partitioned. But it's geographic Poland. Rabbi Hartman says, a similar situation happened in America with conservative rabbis who issued Piskei Halacha like driving a car on Shabbos. Many Jews, members of Orthodox shuls, were not educated, followed that. Yes, we spoke about that. Again, thank you for repeating that. I'm going to make a copy of this. I'm not going to play it now, but thank you, Ruth. The Tetris theme, I'm going to I put it on my computer now. Chaim says, there's a story that the rabbis rescinded their heter to carry a $20 bill on Shabbos when muggers began stopping from Jews and for the and for the 20 you're carrying for me. I don't know what the end of that is, but unless you're saying that the muggers began to know that Dafka, they were carrying money, and then they'd start robbing everyone. The money is muktzah. So it all would depend on how, dangerous it is. We allow people to carry guns, and that's muktzah. So you need a posek to evaluate how dangerous it is. Because you could say, well, stay home, but they won't say that. They won't say stay home because you should be able to go to shul on Shabbos. An Erev Yom Kippur of 71 or 72, a young Orthodox man was killed by some Harlem youth on the Upper West Side because he had no money when held up. So it's stories like that that these were some liberal modern Orthodox rabbis. Cigarettes, okay. Okay, and the last thing I'll say, Mark points out, we did 100%. We used to say, even when I was young, many more slichot, we just would go right through them. Hebrew, we don't do that anymore, at least none of the shuls I've been at. We say one, usually the rabbi. The Rav was doing this. I mean, the Rav started giving, he would explain the different slichos. And then J.J. Schachter, he's been doing it for many years now.
No, it's not slichot.
Kinos, yeah, kinos, he does. Okay, sorry, they do for kinos. But it's the same idea. We do limited slichos, and we do limited kinos. Kinos, we explain them. Slichos, we don't explain them, but at least in my show, we don't. It would be nice if we did. I shouldn't say that. The rabbi of my show, he gives like a one sentence, like who wrote it sort of thing. But I don't know. Maybe we should have more explanations of slichos, just like we do with kinos. We're saying it. These are said by Rishonim, and there's a whole history. There was a rabbi in England, forget his name, before the Art Scroll Sichos, the Rosenbaum Sichos. He has all the authors of it. It might be a good idea to explain what the Sichos are all about. Okay, with that, I give it to you, Rabbi Kelman.
So, you know, our shul in Or Chaim, we used to say slichas every for COVID. I think last year I didn't go, I guess, but they would say they davmarv at 9:30 and then say slichas. You know, okay, whatever. That's a whole other discussion.
That's my shul too.
For 2 years, I decided I gave every night before slichas for 15 minutes. Just a mini explanation of the slichas in advance, like we do for kinos. I said we should all do it. It's not going to work in the morning the way it does on Tisha B'Av. You can sit there and explain kinos. Slichas in the morning, nobody's going to sit around. So I figured, let's give a 50-minute shiur. We had slichas in the night, go over it. So it was a very nice idea, I thought. It was hard because, you know, nobody understands. I had a few books, whatever. It was good for me. And like 4 people showed up. You know, 25 people showed up to slichas, but like to the explanation of slichas, that was so people are not so interested.
Okay, but Rabbi Kelman,
they have to waste time on Tisha B'Av. They have to pass the fast day, so they're willing to sit in.
Okay, but that's Rabbi Kelman's weakness. He loves to teach Torah. I can tell you, I'll embarrass him now. I'll be upset, but he was the rabbi in residence at the program, and he wanted to do something different. Shocking. When you do the siyum, mashas, you know, the siyum of the masechta. Everyone assumes you go. The guy who did it, he does it, does the last 2 lines in 2 minutes and says the Kaddish, and then you can all leave. But Rabbi Kelman had the idea that if you're partaking in the Siyum, radical, that you should actually know something about the Siyum, about the Masechta, a little burning.
They asked me once in Or Chaim if I would make the Siyum. I told them, I'm making the Siyum, but it's going to take minimum of 20 minutes. I don't do a Siyum where I read a line. If I'm going to do a Siyum, I'm going to explain the first paragraph. So if people are willing to spend for 20. So if it's on Good Friday or Pesach, okay. So the next year, they didn't ask me to give the Siyum.
We had to because we couldn't eat without the Siyum, and everyone enjoyed it, and it was worthwhile.
No, whenever I do a Siyum, of course. It's the same thing if I ever do a wedding. Yeah, of course. I always explain. You know, I don't do very many weddings, but if I do a wedding, so I always explain every piece of why we read the Ksuva and how women's institute and what they're suing, Kiddushin. How many comments I get that because people, Orthodox people, don't know this stuff. If they know, they just, you know, they go what the Shabbat brachas is, when they come from, a little each one for 30 seconds. You know, it doesn't
matter. Rabbi Kelman, if you had said that I'm going to do 15 minutes of slichas explanation and the rest of the slichas, in other words, the total time is not going to be greater, you would have gotten a greater attendance from another.
I mean, sometimes I got 7 people. You know, like, but I'm saying nobody. Listen, okay, it was the weeknight, busy. I'm just saying, like. Tisha B'Av lends itself to this. And of course, we all, I've been doing it for years. I mean, the last 2 years in COVID. This year, I was outdoors minyan. I didn't go to shul in 2020 for Tisha B'Av, but 2021 I went. And I came to shul. They said to me, Rabbi, can you go explain the kid? With no preparation. I had no idea. So I gave many explanations, like off the top of my head, not the way I would normally do it. But but people want, because the keynote are totally meaningless if you don't explain them. And people want to kill time. So it's good. It works well for keynote. And you're right. The Rav would go there straight to 5 o'clock, and J.J. Schechter's book is fantastic. If you haven't read it before Tisha B'Av,
You can watch him live or other rabbis.
They have everything online. Listen, Mark, if I can tell you, our biggest classes in the history of Torah Motion, we're coming very soon. I don't know the exact count. We're at about 980 classes now since Zoom has started. We're approaching our 1,000th class. I think it's pretty amazing, actually. 1,000 classes, I would say. Probably 100,000 people have attended live, not to mention probably, the people who listen afterwards. You know, we had classes, but our biggest classes ever were on Tisha B'Av, 300 people, 250 people. Our big classes now get 100 people, like, is really good. But Tisha B'Av, 300 now, like a year ago, whatever, 10 months ago, 9 months ago, whatever Tisha B'Av was. You got 300 people coming to classes. That's great. I mean, it's great. People are looking for stuff to do on Tisha B'Av, But anyways, okay. Any other comments? People are still here. If you have any ideas how to get more people to come to classes, let me know. But, please God, I'll figure out, we'll announce our 1,000 class, and then we'll ask everybody to give a $1,000 donation, get 1,000 people to give a $1,000 donation, raise $1 million. Because our budget is too low. I'm joking because it won't happen, but I'm serious.
How about 1,000 people, $100?
Right. Yeah. That. So I may do something. I'll see. Anybody ideas? Let me know. Let me know how much you're willing to give. I normally don't do this. I know, but I'm sorry. Okay. But it's true. So I think that's, if I can say, I'm a little proud of that. Baruch Hashem, we're approaching our 1,000th class on Zoom. And I think the range of speakers and the quality and the different topics, I think we can compete with anybody. So, Bart, I want to thank you. This couldn't happen without all our people who come. And Amen Kesef Ein Torah, that would be nice too. That would be
indeed. By the way, this is you listen to a podcast often. All you're doing is hearing the person speak. At least I can say my classes could not take place without the give and take and the people with it's essential.
No, it's great. Listen, how many people I've met, listen, now online, people I didn't know, and people have come, and I think, Baruch Hashem, listen, all kinds of good things. So I want to thank you, and really, if any comments, we're always looking for new people and new ideas, and, we have our regulars, Dr. Mark, we got our regulars, and then we have, always looking for new things to add in. So, Bakasha. Okay, everybody. So I don't know if talking about Bali Kavana, Harbe Kavana, coming to learn, but anyways, that's the way it goes. Okay, tomorrow.